Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to episode 231. Today I'm joined with Emmett Peppers, and I just want to invite you here. How are you doing?
Good, Dave. How are you? 231 episodes now. Wow, that's a huge library. I've listened to, I think, almost every one.
And oh, wow.
You do a great job.
Awesome, yeah. Man. Yeah, it's exciting. 2021. How are you doing this year?
This year, I'm doing all right. I mean, I feel like 2021 is going to be a better year, you know, once we get this vaccine rollout under control, you know, on the right track, and, you know, hopefully some stability in politics, and, you know, hopefully less anxiety amongst the population, and hopefully it'll be a good year. We'll see. How about you? How's it going for you so far?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 2021 has been a year of a lot of changes. We've moved to Austin and adjusting here. But otherwise, yeah, I can't complain. Our kids are healthy. They're happy, having a blast, you know, every day. And so, yeah, it's been fun. So in today's episode, I want to cover and discuss a bunch of different topics with you. I want to talk about your options contract on Tesla that we've been following, kind of what happened. I also want to talk about stock prices, and we'll take Tesla as an example, and how we could kind of use human psychology to try to have an edge on viewing stock prices. And then I want to talk about any strategies on investing and trading in 2021, how you're viewing the markets. And then we'll hit a bunch of Twitter questions toward the end, if that's all right.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah.
Awesome. So the first topic is, so Tesla is in the 800s. And so I had this thought I wanted to kind of share with you and discuss is most people, they didn't expect Tesla to be in the 800s right now, just 2 months ago. Like 2 months ago, we're at $400, right? And so when you did this like 700, was it just 700 strike?
Option call. Yeah, 700. Strike.
Like people thought you were crazy, or some people, but we're at 800. You know, this is kind of like your long shot, you know, idea here. But what's funny, what's interesting is people have acclimated to this stock price so fast. You know, it's almost like people feel like we've been up here all this time, you know?
And so
there's this concept of acclimation. People acclimate to kind of whatever stock price is for the past few weeks, maybe like the past month or so, people just get used to it. It's like they have short-term memory in a sense. And then the second concept I was thinking about recently is people are projecting always like what's been happening. They project it to continue in the future. And it seems like these two concepts are deeply rooted in human psychology somehow. Kind of this human ability to acclimate very quickly. Right, it's like I think it's from our ancestors all the way to now, but also this ability to project, kind of like the past into the future trends. Like, what are your thoughts? How do you fall into this sometimes? Like, do you get acclimated to the stock price?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the 800s, when you were talking just now, it made me think of an analogy some people use of like top speed versus acceleration in like a car or something. And going from 400 to 800 was like a big acceleration, you know, and people on one hand think this acceleration is going to continue. And then you also have the other hand is the top speed is, you know, sort of think of it that way. It's like in the 400s, now it's the 800s. And people just expect the top, you know, they have a hard time getting used to it, or maybe they get used to the top speed of being 800. So it's like two different things. I think it's more dangerous to keep thinking we're going to keep accelerating continuously. It might happen, but I think the 800s, where we're at now, you know, it's okay to consolidate and maybe we drop down a little bit before another leg up later. A lot of it depends on the macro market, you know, what if the whole market's due for a big correction, you know, but if not, I think Tesla holds where it is now and maybe goes up over time slower at a much slower acceleration. You know, I thought that the S&P inclusion event was kind of a, you know, the last great short-term trade opportunity for Tesla in my mind. And, you know, maybe there'll be others, but I just don't know where they would be. It could happen anytime, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I think, people are getting used to the 800s and they're just like, hey, this is where it should be. And like the crazy thing is, like you said, like people get used to it so quickly sometimes, like let's say next week something drives it up to like 1200. Well, then 2 weeks we'll be talking about people being used to it in the 1200s, you
Exactly.
know, and it's crazy.
I mean, in a sense, like that's I feel like how bubbles happen. Like, with the dot-com bubble, people just got used to the stock price like going up and up and up. And you know, do you get concerned at all? I mean, I feel like in some ways, people are losing kind of the people who are valuation focused, people who are on traditional valuation methods. I feel like they're starting to give up their kind of methods to value companies. It just feels like everything is getting stretched so far out. And I feel like there's two things that could happen. One thing is like this just continues and valuations just get higher and higher. And we could be into some dangerous territory. But on the flip side, it seems like, hey, you've got low interest rates. You've got, you know, a lot of money that's looking to be deployed into, you know, return capital. And so in some ways, maybe it's high for a period, but maybe it'll catch up, meaning, maybe it's a different era in a sense of investing with all this money chasing a limited number of assets. So what are your thoughts kind of with that?
Yeah, I agree. We don't know if it's a different era we're in the beginnings of or even in the middle of versus a bubble that's close to ending. You know, it's hard to know. I think a lot of people are afraid to enter the market because it's at highs, you know, and they think it's a bubble and they're waiting for it to drop. And if there's enough people doing that, then that almost counters I feel like the market dropping significantly, because if it drops 5%, you have a certain amount of those people jumping in to back it up and so forth. And that could continue for a while as well. But like you said, we're in a new era of interest rates, and growth stocks are growing, you know, revenues using technology at faster rates than ever before. You know, like this is a new era of history we're entering, the 2020s, and it's, you know, the pace of change is accelerating, you know. And so I think in certain growth stocks and technology-based stocks, their revenues are going to accelerate, you know, as well. And yeah, it could be a whole new era. Like people are looking for stores of value of their wealth, right? Bitcoin, obviously, some people are looking at now, and I think good stocks, good companies, people are starting to do the same thing. So you have, you know, retail investors or high net worth people putting excess capital of their stores of wealth in stocks as opposed to bonds, you know, and then instead of cash too, and so that helps prop up the prices, and we could be in for, you know, who knows? It could be a decade of these like high valuation prices, and or it could be just another month. It's, no one really knows.
It reminds me of kind of what's going on with real estate right now. It's like you have certain cities that are hit that were kind of more densely populated, but generally speaking, like suburbs and just single family houses and places that have decent standard of living, you're just seeing like these real estate prices just really strong, you know, at least in the markets that I follow. Specifically, like, you know, coming from California, now coming into Texas and just hearing in different, you know, cities as well. And it's interesting because I feel like part of it is, yeah, there's a low interest rate thing going on. And there's also the dynamics of people appreciating kind of housing, kind of their own yard in the midst of COVID. But there's also this, maybe this underlying like fear of inflation or this chasing of like, hey, we got to put our money into something, you know? And I mean, this is where I kind of resonate with the whole Bitcoin crowd is, you know, I feel like there is a legitimate, you know, fear of inflation or it just kind of spiraling, you know? And the Fed, the government losing control in a sense. So this is like I had a fa family member who's in retirement now trying to decide kind of where to put some assets, and they were gonna put it into just cash, you know, like a decent amount, let's say 20 something percent into cash. And they were going to sell a piece of real estate to do that. And I looked at the real estate and I was like, oh man, this real estate is actually pretty good. It's like it's in a great location. It's a residential thing. They'll get income, it's cash flowing, it's paid off. And I'm like, ha, you're selling real estate to put into cash. But I'm like, oh man, I think you should keep it in real estate. Keep it in that property because you're going to pay taxes if you pull it out. And where are you going to put your money? You know, like in a safe place. It's just like you just don't have that many places. And I feel like in some ways that type of idea is, it's not just between me and, you know, that family member, but there's a lot of that idea going on where are you going to put your money? And it's like you need a place to grow it, you know, and especially in kind of uncertain times. And so, yeah, real estate, you know, it seems like a lot of money is going to that, and then stocks, you know, a lot of money is going into the stock market. And a lot of people are getting into investing. Like I keep on hearing it from my wife's like friends and other people who are just like taking ownership of their own investing, you know, and putting money into it because they're like, what else do we do? Right? This is kind of like it's hope to find a better future. And I feel like there's a lot of dynamics going on where there's definitely something I think long term, I'm definitely bullish, you know, on assets that are productive, that have, you know, very tangible meaning. And so real estate and stocks, you know, I mean, they're great in some ways.
Good companies and real estate and cash. I think if you naturally come, it seems hard to like purposely sell something that's already in, in a good place to create tax consequences for yourself just to hold cash, for example. But I feel like if you happen to have cash, a good amount of cash, like I, now that I liquidated those options, those short-term options, for example. I'm keeping it, I have to pay a huge amount of taxes on that too, but I'm keeping some cash just on the side, as dry powder for the next 5 or 10% dip, like I talked about, and then I can deploy that, for example. So I think it's not a bad idea to have cash if it, to not just be not be afraid to have cash if it's a good reason that you fell into having cash. But like you, I think it also makes sense, like you said, not to purposely like create not, negative tax consequences for yourself just to for the purpose of having, 20 or 30% cash in your portfolio.
Yeah, definitely. With this, I'm curious, like how much, what percent of your like portfolio overall are you holding cash right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, I think it's like 15 or 20%,
Really?
maybe
Wow.
30%. Actually, it's more. It's like 30% or more. Yeah, the IRA account. I was thinking of the non-IRA account. Yeah, so it's like of the non-IRA account, it's probably like 20 to 30% cash, and the IRA account. Yeah, same thing. But I just put half of that cash into a value-based ETF model with an advisor that it's like sort of a hedge, emergency hedge in case like value stocks come back, and I'll have some value there in my IRA, which is like I don't want to touch that hopefully ever, but it's sort of like holding it in cash, but also it's still in the market in case growth stocks get destroyed and it'll still appreciate. So that's sort of what I thought about with the IRA cash, some of it.
Got it. And so that's just half, or is that your IRA, half of your
Yeah, half the
IRA?
more, a little more than half the cash in my IRA went to
Okay,
that.
to
Yeah,
that. Okay.
and then the non-IRA account. I haven't done anything with that, the cash generated from the trade yet, but I know like half of that cash or more is going to go to taxes.
Okay.
So then I have the rest of it just going to kind of sit on the sidelines for a while until I
Got
see a
it.
big opportunity potentially.
Yeah, so maybe after taxes, what you think 10, 15% will be left of your portfolio
Yeah,
in cash?
15% of my 15 to 20%, probably, yeah, maybe something of the personal account, maybe 20%, maybe 15 to 20% at the
Something,
most.
huh? So, what's your strategy? Let's say if you're thinking perhaps there might be some type of correction, or you, who knows, like when, you know, or how, because like a lot of these things are like you could try to predict it, but there's so many factors involved, you know, and it's like a chain reaction of so many different things that to predict right now when the exact correction or downturn, et cetera, it's extremely difficult, I think. But like when you look at kind of being prepared for a possible correction or whatever, like what's your strategy? You hold cash. Are you looking to kind of wait till something just happens where the market's down like 10, 15, 20%, and then you'll start buying options at that point? Or kind of what's your mindset?
Yeah, I mean, I'll either buy stock or if I think it's really going down, maybe some options. If like Tesla really overcorrected, I buy long-term options again at that. If Tesla got cut in half, you know, and then I'd consider buying long-term leaps, you know, in Tesla again. But it would have to go down to like the 400s or something again for that. But otherwise, if it went to like the 500 or 600s, maybe I'd start buying some stock or something. But I would kind of piece into it with, you know, I wouldn't do it all, deploy all that at once. I would wait for it to keep dropping, kind of like dollar cost average a little more as it goes down further. But that may not ever happen, but I'm prepared if it does. And it's always good to have a little dry powder. I for a while I thought that, you know, I had this kind of foresight that I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I just had this strong feeling that, you know, the market's recovered really well. The tech stocks, especially with this COVID crash, you know, recovery. But the economy is still not like 100%. And, you know, something just doesn't feel right, you know, and a lot of people sense that, I think. But I know like the market often does what no one expects, right? And part of me thinks that's going to be, you know, as we come out of this COVID crisis in our economy, like maybe jobs pick up, maybe everyone gets the vaccine, and we're kind of back to work as usual, or, you know, just everyone can go out of the house and not worry about restaurants reopen, all that. That maybe that's the point when there's like a bubble burst and the stocks kind of crash, you know, 20% or 30% because no one expects it at that point. You know, people are like the market might even go up another 10 or 20% until then. I don't know, but I just feel like that's the ultimate like stock market, you know, play in a game, you know, the game that always wins, right? And the stock market always beats us, right? And I feel like that's what's gonna happen. I don't know. I'm kind of waiting for that. And
In a scenario like that, would you try to ride the down, like, trend
buy
as
some puts
well?
or something.
Yeah, like, and would you look at some maybe what you think might be some overpriced kind of hype stocks and try to buy puts, or what would you do, you think?
Yeah, you know, it's not like the COVID crash, which I felt like was really imminent within a few weeks, where I felt like I could just buy. That was like, you know, almost a year ago now. And I was buying like those puts and stuff and index puts. But so it's not like it's harder to time than that in a way. Like, you know, it's not going to be like a 2 week period where suddenly the economy is back to normal. It's going to be like a few month period, you know. So I might consider buying some like index puts that are like 3 or 6 months out periodically, you know, second half of this year if it hasn't happened yet, for example, if they're cheap enough, if they're not too expensive and the markets are still at all-time highs, you know, that's what I might consider doing, but not with a huge amount of my money, just a smaller portion of the because I have these gains I realized at the start of this year. So it makes sense to be able to offset. It's almost like I'd be buying those puts half off in a way, because if they expired worthless, well, now I just knocked off my tax bill for the gains I already, you know, experienced to start this year. So
Got it, huh? Interesting. So I guess it makes it a little cheaper to do some betting.
yes, it's like half the price. Half the
Exactly.
price for me. Yeah,
Half
it's kind of
price
wild.
betting for Emmett 2021.
Yeah, that's how I think of it, because I include the taxes in part as part of it. Yeah.
So going back to this, your January 15 options kind of play that you closed out. What happened? You cashed
Yeah.
out half earlier on in back in December.
Yeah, for like a six, I think it was a 6x gain on the first half I closed out one Friday in December. And then I was like, I'm going to keep the other half and let it ride for a while. And then I think it was January 8th, I think, is when I sold them. And that was when this Tesla stock was around 875. I got out of all of them for like $176 or so. I don't know. So I got out of most of the other half. You know, I kept the, you know, 5 or 10% of the overall. I think like 10% of the remaining position or something like that. I kept and I took assignment over this past weekend of those shares. So that'll take away some of my cash too, but not too much. But yeah, I got out. Luckily, it seems like at the right time before it came back down.
So
and yeah, then, I just had a sense. I just felt like there was exuberance, and you know, we've watched the stock every day. You know, you and I talk about how we check our watch or whatever for this ticker price like 100 times a day or 50 times a day or 10 times, whatever it is, every day. There's not a day I haven't checked it multiple times. And over 10 years of doing that, there's, I don't know if there's pattern recognition. I don't know what it is. You just have some kind of sense of like the stock price. And, you know, I could have easily been wrong, but I just felt like, all right, we've gone up a lot here, 875. This is like something was like told me like, this is a good time to get out. Like if it goes up to 900 plus, I still made a killing. And I actually got out of my 900 calls. You know, I had a few hundred, 900 calls. Mm-hmm. So I got out of those at even money like a couple of days before, but then I had 100 left and I got out of those at like 20, you know, for a 5X return on the last 100 of those. So I made a profit on that mistake.
Even the 900s.
That was a mistake. Yeah, so you learn to cut over time, you learn to cover your mistakes in a better, you know, that's what I've learned also is, how to recognize and cover my mistakes and sometimes at a profit, even though I know it was a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, like when I look at your, not just this past year, but this whole, you know, option call or the January 15 options we've been following on, you know, on these videos, it's almost like, it's almost too good to be true.
It feels like that.
Yeah.
It's like we totally planned. Like I thought there was a 20% chance it would work out. We said that in the beginning and it's crazy how it worked out the way, you know, we respect.
I mean, I think if we didn't do it live, you know, like along the way, I don't know how many people would really believe like that actually worked out. Like, like, I think on one side, like, I think what's remarkable is that you did have not like you said 20%, but you did have a higher, you know, probability in your mind, and you, so much so that you thought it would be quote unquote irresponsible for you not to at least try something with 5 or 10%. But on the flip side, it's remarkable that it worked out, you know, like, like there's a high probability that it could have turned the other way, you know? And I think one of the things is like, that worked out in your favor was the quick, you know, stock price bump in the first like couple of weeks. It just made your trade profitable right off the bat, you know? And then it was just like from there, you know, deciding what to do. But yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, I think, just to follow it and to see kind of like the, I wouldn't say the power of betting, but it's like, it's calculated risk taking, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I know a lot of people, they tend to bag on gambling and they go like, oh, you know, gambling is bad, right? And especially you have the long-term investor crowd. They're like short-term betting options, you know, everything, trading is bad, right? And like, I think what's interesting about your example just this past year, but also in the past few months, is that it's an interesting take on betting, in a sense, you know, on gambling, and it's trying to analyze through a calculated kind of way and try to find an edge, right? Try to, and that's one of the reasons why in the first kind of videos of this January, you know, 15, 20, 21 option call trade, I was just trying to poke at different angles to try to like see what your thesis was, you know. Even though I held a lot of the same views, I was just trying to see like, okay, what is it that you're calculating, you know, and basing your trade off of? And I think it was an interesting experience because you're like, oh, okay, it's not just a blind bet, but you're betting against certain things, you know, like you're betting against some psychology of the markets, you're betting against some, you know, the big money coming in, you know, the dynamics, the structure of, you know, shares and the S&P 500.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, supply and demand, exactly. And so it in a way, it's a calculated bet that you could lose, but you think you have the odds greatly in your favor. And
and I was able to turn into like a 16 times return in 2 months. I mean, that's crazy, right? It sounds like too good to be true, like you said. Like, how is that even possible? But there's, you know, it's like it was a unique opportunity. Like you and I had been talking about it, and I've been talking about it with friends and other Tesla friends of mine, like this S&P inclusion. We've been ready for that, you know, and it was just the right
Did you
time.
have you calculated what the total like return is? Because you spent what?
Yeah, so 6x return to start, and then the other half was like a 25x return. So it averaged to like a 15 or 16x return
15 or
on the
16.
whole.
So wait, you put down 3 million, was it, or what did you put down?
Like 3 point something, and
Something.
I think
Okay.
it brought like what, like 40 or 50,
40 or 50. I mean, this is
total.
you ended up with 40 or 50.
Extra, yeah.
Or
From
profit.
three turned into like 40 or 50,
40,
you know.
50.
So it was like
Okay.
what, 3 times 15 is like 45, you know,
45 or
something like
so,
that.
something
Yeah,
around there.
3.5 times 15 is
And then you
50,
minus what, over
like
half
that.
taxes, right, off of that.
Yeah, minus over half that
Yeah.
taxes, and I took assignment of some of the
Got it.
shares. So yeah,
Okay.
so I mean, it was extraordinary. I mean, people are fighting hard just to get like, you know. I see people on Twitter selling out of the money covered calls, and like, if I do this all year long, I can get an extra 10%. You know, and then you magnify that 160 or 1,600 times, and you get a 16x return in 2 months. Is that right? Yeah, it's like crazy. It's like you're talking apples and oranges there with you know, how much thought process you should put into different ideas or strategies. So to me, like the betting, like the calculated bets, they can have such huge payoffs. If you just have a little bit of an edge once in a while, like we've had with Tesla, then you have enormous return potential, you know, and it's just it's there's something odd about it. It's almost like a cheat code or so, I don't know, like a hole in the system that, like, you know, you can kind of figure out, and who knows how long that hole will be open or if it'll ever open again. But for Tesla, you know, some people just bought stock and watched it go up 10x over, you know, the year. But if you did it with options, you could get 100x or more, you know, and that's kind of like hard, you know. I don't know if that opportunity will come up again, but it was definitely seemed like a hole in the system to me for this year.
So wait, I have to process this. So you put down 3 point something million, and
Yeah.
then it goes up to, let's say, 45 million or something,
Yeah.
or across your
Something
three
around there.
accounts, let's
Yeah.
say.
It's a little complicated, but I sold half and then I sold the other half later. And then I kept a couple, like a 10% to take assignment.
That's
And then in my hedge fund, I did it a little different, but it wasn't nearly as big of a position in the hedge fund as, so I really discount the hedge fund from it.
Got
I'm
it.
trying to just, I just focus on my
Yeah. So you
personal accounts.
made well over 40 million on your trade, huh? Okay. Yeah, that's pretty crazy, man.
I mean, you know, I see a lot of people on Twitter saying like, yeah, how do you get to that? And like we've talked about, you know, I was starting with $30,000 10 years ago doing this stuff, you know, and you have a couple outlier years, and suddenly it's 30 or 40 million instead of 30 or 40,000 in your kind of claim. It's kind of crazy.
So one of my things I've been thinking about your situation is, I'm like, why try a hedge fund where you're gonna have to start catering to different people's expectations, change your style? Now you're gonna have to be like, you have to market yourself, like, you know, like think about it. With a hedge fund, it's like, what is it? You know, it's all about, you know, it's like management fees and carry, but you have to like reach out to these people. I mean, it's like it's work, right?
It
It's and
is.
it's not like it's not your bread and butter of what you've done to this point to really get outsized gains. You know, you're setting up a whole nother just entity and structure and work and
Business.
commitments and expectations, and you're di in a sense, you will dilute and change what you've done for that structure. But it's like, why? Like, why just not, why don't you just focus on what has been working, or, you know, and push out the noise? Like, what are your thoughts with that?
That's a good point. There's three things I would say. One is my career path up to this point before I left my job kind of helped prepare me for that. It was, you know, I helped start up hedge funds. That was my job, like, you know, for 10 years. I worked with, you know, probably over 100 startup hedge funds. And so I understand from one standpoint what goes into it, how it works. It's not like totally new to me. And I've always been curious to do it myself, you know. On the other hand, If it doesn't work out to be, if it becomes too much work or too much of a headache, I have no problem just shutting it down, returning the capital back to investors. I'm not fighting hard to sell, oversell anything. I have a couple people I've hired, one's my cousin and he's great work ethic and he's just going, doing a good job. So I'm trying to make it as less work for me personally. And if it turns out that it is a ton of work for me personally and it's a pain in the butt, I could shut it down. I don't, I totally know that's a real realistic possibility. And the third thing is, I'm also doing it, I like the fact that I'm expanding my investment philosophy to really kind of press it on in different angles and see what I can do with it. Kind of challenging myself to think even more different, just to evolve my investment decisions more, in a way that I wouldn't otherwise maybe, So I'm not going to be totally traditional hedge fund with 100 positions, obviously, but I'm going to try to keep around 10 or so. It's going to stretch me, personally. I'm the decision maker. I'm the, so it's going to stretch me a lot. But maybe I'll learn something from it, or maybe I'll improve things. And if the hedge fund does succeed, then there's a huge, good component to it in terms of what I think it could, the ultimate win would be if it becomes extremely successful and lots of other people do something similar where they're giving a lot to charity, and that's why I'm doing it really. It's there's a chance it could really be successful and make other funds do the similar thing and changes it creates a new trend like ESG, but instead of ESG investing, it's like charitable giving investing or something,
Got it.
That's really what drives me. But if it fails, it fails. I know more likely than not it would fail. Most hedge funds shut down within a couple of years if they don't beat the market and such.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, as you shared before, what half of your profits will go into your or not half your profits,
Foundation
but
after
the
fees.
fees, right, that you charge will go into your foundation for a nonprofit or charitable giving. All right, awesome, man. Let's go to some Twitter questions. Joshua George on Twitter says, my question is, as a long-term investor, are you supposed to keep track of the stock every single day? I feel like watching the stock every day is very exhausting. Any tips on this? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think becoming obsessive if your portfolio is so concentrated in one stock primarily, I think it's important to follow that stock very carefully. But it's definitely a distraction, right? But if you had a small business, you'd want to keep a close eye on it, right? If you owned a pizza shop and that was like the main, most of your wealth was in a pizza shop, you'd want to make sure it's operating well and you wouldn't want to just like forget about it for weeks at a time, right? So I think it's sort of similar. Like if you're highly concentrated on a particular stock, it makes sense to follow it closely, and it can be stressful at times, especially when there's lots of FUD going on with that company, like Tesla for many years. But the more you study it every day and look at the ticker, the more you can see, the truth on that those narratives and such. One thing I wanted to mention on the if we go back to the hedge fund thing was also I think that the next 10 or 20 years, you have this younger generation of people and socialism is becoming more popular, and I think there's a bridge that can be done that's, with UBI if it's done the right way and so forth. But I also see there's danger in like a revolt against capitalism entirely, And so I'm trying to help change that perspective or not, or prevent that from happening. And if enough if enough people do something similar with the hedge fund, I think that can help play a role in preventing like a revolt against capitalism or something. I don't know. That's just kind of in a nutshell. Anyway, sorry to go backwards
Yeah,
on
definitely.
stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, actually, well, that was actually another question someone had is don't have it written down, but one person was asking about do you have any ideas to do like 10x or 100x giving in terms of the impact? Like, have you thought about any out-of-the-box approaches that might be maybe non-traditional or, different that will get an outsized return, in charitable giving. Have you ever thought about stuff like that?
Yeah, I have. And I, the part of the reason I called it, the good soil investment management is from the parable of the sower, where they say, the seed that lands on the good soil will return 50 or 100. So not just in terms of investment returns, but I want to treat the giving to be something similar, where I want to, when I give, when the foundation's giving money, I want it to be for high quality causes that I think is very meaningful, and that's a whole nother job and discussion I have to take very seriously. And I just, in 2020, at the end of 2020, I donated a bunch of my own stock to start to kick off the foundation with, for, and I've just started the process of looking at things to give to. And, I gave a little to the Barstool Fund after I saw Elon did it, but there's other things I'm looking at closely. And that's a whole nother like point of focus I have to think about, and maybe if you have any ideas, if anyone's got good ideas for that, I'm open to ideas, obviously, and giving.
I'm
What do
thinking.
you think?
I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, the past few years, but more so the past years, is kind of what's this approach to really giving in a way that, like, because part of it, part of my whole investing approach is I see potential that is far greater than maybe a traditional approach, of maybe investing in the market or whatever. And I also feel that with certain skills and approaches, you can have an edge to pick some big winners. And so with giving, I feel like there's got to be a hack also with giving in some way to maximize giving and its impact. But I kind of separate it. So one part of giving, I kind of say, okay, it's for myself and my character and my own type of ability to empathize. So it's like, for me, if a person gets so isolated and removed from needs of people, it doesn't matter what they do with their money. They're just like, they don't get it. They just, and that you miss the whole point. You're disqualified in a sense because like you don't care, and so the first part of giving is just caring, is actually feeling that connection, knowing people in need, feeling that need, like getting to really, and that's why I've always had this this value of kind of trying to get connected to people in need locally, whether they might be drug addicts or homeless people or just people in great need, and finding the most needy people and meeting them and feeling and connecting with that. And so that's part of kind of my approach to giving, even though it doesn't necessarily have a high monetary value per se, it's a more of a high time value and priority value that I think needs to go along with any financial giving, because I feel like they go together. And then with financial giving, I have this approach where I want to give to people that I trust and that I know that are doing things that are that aren't being done and are being extremely effective with it. And so, for example, like we know a therapy counseling group out in Boston that does like counseling for adopted kids and kids with trauma, abuse, and they have amazing results. Like they're by far the most effective group I've seen in the nation. And we know the head very well. And that type of group, I'm like, that's a big return. Because
Send me that after this, send me that later, the contact for them.
because other therapy groups, they can spend hundreds of sessions on the most abused and violent, let's say, kids, and they might not have that great effect, but this group in 12 sessions, they like have radical impact on the most violent, abused, just really, trauma
They have a
background
unique
kids.
approach or
Yeah,
something.
it's a unique approach, and it's really actually first principles therapy. It's amazing. I'm just like, wow, man, you guys, they blew me away. And I'm like, they're a small outfit, I think their total budget is probably under 400,000 for a group of like three or four people, but that's high return because I'm like they're doing something that no other, therapy group I've seen is doing, their
They're almost like
approach.
disrupting that field in a way,
Yeah, they're
right? They're not like
disrupting
trying to
it.
outcompete anyone. They're just trying to do something good, but it's doing it in a way better way or something.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know how much really and they're capable of taking it and really utilizing, but
Scaling it up or
scaling, et
something,
cetera.
maybe.
And I don't know what their ambition is, but like stuff like that, I'm fascinated by. I'm like, wow, that's interesting. But there is a limitation of how much I can personally know and, get involved and stuff. So there's kind of like this question mark I'm having as well. One of the other things I'm trying to do is I want to encourage people to start their businesses, own businesses, and to be creative with it. Because just like you, I feel like in a way there is kind of a growing discontentment with the system and with capitalism, wealth inequality, et cetera. And you have a growing a crowd chanting kind of more rights to from the government, just saying. And I feel like a lot of, I mean, I'm not going to discount that completely, but I feel like there's amazing opportunity in the world to to be able to harness the knowledge of people out there and to start unique opportunities to create businesses. And they might be small businesses, they might be medium businesses, might be partnerships, I don't know what, but I'm really kind of curious of doing kind of these small type of grants on my channel, actually like recruiting, having some type of contest where I say, okay, pitch a business idea, et cetera, and we'll give a small amount, like just so you could get off the ground, like $10,000 or something, and that could mean a lot actually for a person who is like 10,000 is a lot of, money, like that could really help them for a whole year to get something off the ground. And during that time, we could, maybe pull some resources together or something to really make it where they have a better chance, a slightly better chance. Of course, it's going to be up to them. But I'd love to do something like that and see if it could scale or not. I don't know. And I wouldn't even take equity, I'm kind of like, that's beyond the
I'd be down
point.
for that. Yeah,
Yes,
I'd be
that's
down
be
for doing that. Maybe you and I could do it together at some point. I would do it without even taking it. Yeah, I mean, I
Exactly. I
think
mean,
small businesses are important.
it's the ethos behind it, saying, hey, let's own it, I mean, that's, and personally for me, like that's where I got the capital to invest is through starting a business and, and spotting opportunity, where others, maybe didn't see the opportunity. But yeah, just, I think it's a statement
That's a
of,
nice idea.
yeah, statement of belief that there's opportunity. Like, I think that's also a tricky part. A lot of people stop believing there's opportunity, and they get into a spiral of hopelessness where they're like, oh, I can never get out of where I'm at. But I think some things need to counter that. And I think, yeah, but anyways, those are some ideas. I'm still pondering a lot of this stuff and,
I like those ideas. Yeah, I have to share these ideas more. That's interesting.
Definitely. All right, so let's go on to Julian Paul. He says, what are your thoughts about a potential Tesla plane? Should Tesla do it? Would they build the whole thing themselves or would they supply batteries and software? What do you think? I think he's talking about like a vertical takeoff and landing electric jet. Like, should Tesla do it? When should they do it? What are your thoughts?
I think they should, and I think they will. I wouldn't be surprised if there's like in, some kind of like, and they're in shadow mode right now with some kind of design. No one even knows what that. When he said that at last $5 billion was for a war chest or what. Who knows? Maybe he's using some, dedicating some of that for the plans of building a vertical takeoff and landing jet. Right. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I would be very surprised. Happily surprised, but I wouldn't be. I would be happy, very happy, but I wouldn't be surprised if in like 2 years there's some kind of surprise product unveiling and it's the vertical takeoff and landing jet like prototype. And then it might be another like 2 to 3 years until the first ones are sold or something. So 5 years out until the first ones are sold. I think he's talked about timelines of the energy density improving on such a track where maybe in 5 years it makes a lot of sense to mass produce the batteries with the right energy density for the vertical takeoff and landing planes to go. I think he said like X 100 miles, which would be a good use or something. So that's just my hunch. You know, I think there's going to be lots of companies trying to beat them to the punch with like prototypes, but we all know you know, Tesla's the only one that can mass produce this stuff. And none of these prototype companies can do crap with anything EV related, it seems like. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I remember, didn't you ask that question to Elon like back in the shareholder meeting? Maybe it was like,
I did. 2016 or so? 17.
Yeah. You asked him if they would go into a Tesla vertical takeoff and landing jet under Tesla or SpaceX or something.
Yeah, that was my thing. I said I'm a very long-term shareholder, mm-hmm. and if you do this, would it be under SpaceX or Tesla? And he said it would be under Tesla.
Yeah. Like, actually, what's interesting is I think it's inevitable that Elon will do something with a vertical takeoff and landing jet. But I think it's likely it would happen under Tesla, but I think it's not as likely as perhaps everyone is assuming. Like, it's 100%. Mm-hmm. I think maybe 70, 80% right now. One of the concerns is Elon is so close to finishing his like 2018 CEO compensation plan tranches. Like, the valuation tranches are all completed, right? So it's like 12 tranches. And then he needs the operational milestones, which are basically the EBITDA profits and some other things. And so with that, I think he's going to be pretty close, probably within 3 years, 2 or 3 years. Mm. Probably 2.5 to 3 years, he's gonna have finished, I think, his CEO compensation plan, and he'll be free to leave Tesla, you know. And I think at that point, Tesla has a few options. Like, some people say, like, oh, Elon's not working at Tesla for the money, so he's gonna stay on at Tesla for the rest of his life, you know. And I think they underestimate like how comprehensive Elon thinks, you know, meaning like he understands that, you know, there's incentives to accomplish bigger goals, you know, that he has. And there's a reason that he's in Tesla for the mission, but he wants to see Tesla's success help, you know, for example, SpaceX's, you know, success as well. So I think like Tesla has a couple options in 2 or 3 years when Elon meets his milestones, which is, one is they could try to offer a new incentive plan, right? Take the company from, let's say, you know, 1 or 2 trillion to 5 trillion or something, you know, over 10 years, and then give him a sizable, you know, incentive plan, which I think, you know, could happen. The other option is Elon says, hey, you know, my time is up and I'm going to focus.
You guys are self-sustaining now.
Exactly.
And I'll be the product architect, but I'm focusing on SpaceX.
SpaceX, yeah, right. And he's alluded to this over in the past, you know, that he will be focusing more on SpaceX. But I think people forget it, or they don't hear it, or, you know, they're not familiar with Elon's thinking, where they don't take him seriously. Like, Elon really is thinking that SpaceX is a greater priority long-term. And if that happens, then I don't know, you know. Like, I think a lot of Tesla's future products, like, I think Tesla does well with their current lineup and what's planned, you know, the roadmap, but with new, fresh, completely new products, you know, like a vertical takeoff and landing jet, that's gonna be hard without, you know, Elon, like, as the CEO, I think. But yeah.
He's said a few times that he'll always remain product architect at Tesla or something like that, in a role of, right, I think he's mentioned that term. But yeah, you know, obviously he'd have a less time, you know, it might be done. It might be harder to execute if there's another CEO or something, but, he could even start another company that's just for vertical takeoff and landing jets that, you know, buys the batteries from Tesla, right? That's possible. He's done Neuralink. He's got all these companies all over the place. The holding company, you know, he's probably got dreams to put together. So, it's hard to know. It's not a given, like you said. But I think it's still a high percentage. But it's definitely not 100% or even 90%. Maybe 70 or 80% in my view.
Next question. VM says, what's a realistic hypothetical view of how competitors could catch up to Tesla? Specifically, how could they reform existing infrastructure, partner with a tech company like Apple, and secure battery supply, let's say from LG Chem? I'm a long-term proponent, but have been surprised by recent exuberance. Yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think we've been seeing this for 10 years now, like the next Tesla killer, you know, and you see these name brand auto companies, you know, Volkswagen or GM, or they just don't, none of them have the DNA. It has to be a company like Apple or Google, but I don't think they, like Apple doesn't have the risk appetite to like go all in, you know, that they'd have to do. They need a Steve Jobs there, you know. They just don't have that DNA. They're mature enough where they're just like, okay, let's keep growing the business we have now efficiently and keep generating cash and dividends. And then and engineering, right? Like, how many years now has SpaceX and Tesla been like the top engineering place for engineers to work at? Like, Tesla has the best engineers in the world working for them, like including Elon Musk, who's like, you know, the top engineer of the past 100 years or something, you know. So it's like, I just don't see meaningful competition. I think there's plenty of room for you know, more competition, but meaningful competition that like eats away at Tesla's you know, ability to sell every car they make, I don't think that's going to happen for many years, you know, 5 to 10 years, maybe longer. I just don't see it unless some like brand new startup comes, if some new like guy that's like better than Elon somehow like emerges out of the shadow and it's like building some crazy stuff. Like, I don't see it happening. What do you think?
I look at China as kind of an interesting place. And there's like several developments in China that are kind of interesting. One is you have Foxconn getting into the whole electric car business. So Foxconn, right, is the manufacturer for iPhones and a bunch of other electronics. They are kind of the recognized world leader in manufacturing. So what China has going for it is they've established kind of this amazing expertise with manufacturing that is like amazing. And a lot of people don't appreciate what China has done with manufacturing, but they've really like honed it to the point where like Tim Cook is saying, there's nowhere else I can go. Like, you know, like China has an amazing advantage over almost any country. There are other countries that are starting to catch up, to emulate what China's doing with manufacturing, but China still has just hundreds of thousands of skilled people in manufacturing with skills and expertise. So if you want things to be manufactured at scale, it's hard to beat what China can offer. And at the top of that is Foxconn. They kind of set the pace, and they've now put their mind on electric vehicles, trying to be kind of a contract maker. And so they just inked a deal with Geely, one of the largest, you know, automakers in China. And then now you have Baidu, which is like the Google of China, the search engine. They've been working on AI and self-driving a bit, but now they're trying to get into making a car, right? And they will tap in. So what's happening is there's a whole supply chain in China that's growing of in electric cars. And then you have CATL, which is like the batteries
The
that even
battery,
Tesla uses, right? But they're probably the most impressive battery company I've seen. They,
More than Panasonic.
yeah, definitely more than Panasonic, more than LG and all these guys, because and Samsung, they actually like deliver on their like goods. Like they have really good batteries at really good cost, and they're scaling fast. I think CATL is by far the top battery manufacturer, and it'll just continue to
Really?
grow. And that's why I think, like, you know, in some ways, it's a like CATL has gone up dramatically in the past 1 year, their stock price. But I've always thought like CATL would be a great kind of like another play, you know, on the EV market. But yeah, CATL, I think, is just going to grow in their dominance with the battery market. But this is all in China. Like, so you have the batteries. You have Foxconn, you have Baidu with self-driving, you have Geely, you have NIO and XPeng. And so these companies are, you know, creating these cars, growing the market and demand. But what all of this stuff combined, the end result is you get pretty good cars at cheap prices, you know, because the whole ecosystem allows for that, right? And they're quite sophisticated vehicles. And people might laugh at it now. They're like, NIO, XPeng or whatever, Chinese cars. But just like people might have laughed at, you know, the Hyundai. What was their first car in the US? Like, I forget. Hyundai, I forget. I remember people were just laughing at the Hyundai when they first came into the US, like in the late 80s. They're just like, this is the worst car ever. Like, no way, there's no way Hyundai can make it, right? And it takes a while. It takes a while, but they're making
Took
cool
off
cars. Yeah.
eventually.
But yeah, that's
Yeah,
yeah.
China does feel like an enigma. Like, I'm uncertain with China. I don't know enough. I'm not, you know,
Yeah.
I do know there's a, you know, that's where competition will come in China, like you said. But is the competition just going to be competition in China, or are those car companies going to expand globally to be competing with Tesla in the US and Europe and wherever else? I don't know about that second part. But the first part, I think, yeah, Tesla will have, you know, will face more serious competition if they do in China first versus anywhere else, I think, for
Yeah,
sure.
definitely. I think it takes time for these Chinese companies to build a brand outside of China, because a lot of thing about a car is its reliability and trust. You didn't want to like drive a car that you don't know its history, right? Or the brand history. And so a lot of times car companies takes like a decade or more, in that country to build that trust. And luckily Tesla has that history, but for a new Chinese company to try to go into the US, it's like extremely difficult. I mean, some are going to try, and it's going to just take time, But I think like the Chinese companies, they probably have the best chance to go in at the kind of to compete with Tesla at this like $25,000 car, in good 3 or 4 years. That's going to be probably the hottest market. And I don't think any other automaker is going to have a chance. I don't know. Unless they do some radical things right now, but yeah. Let's look at so Casper Kelstrup says, hey, Lemonade, so Citron, research came out with a piece or a video saying they're shorting Lemonade. Do you see any similarities between Lemonade shorts and Tesla shorts? And then another person says, hey, we'd love to hear you guys' view on Lemonade's recent stock offering and also their insider selling at 165. Has your investment thesis changed on this company? So have you bought some Lemonade past few
Yeah, I mean,
weeks?
I did in one of my accounts. I bought some, but and I'm a fan, and I've listened to your analysis, and I've read some other analysis from other sources I like. And I haven't tested the product myself yet, so I haven't bought a ton, you know. But I'm trying to build conviction. But what I've gathered so far is that they're building kind of their own backbone technology, which is different from every other insurance company. And I've seen this play out in the brokerage industry with Interactive Brokers firsthand, you know, working there and seeing how superior it can be in cost effectiveness and technology, and the fact that it's got its control of its own ecosystem, doesn't rely on third party or partnerships with, you know, other firms. And so I know how much of an advantage that is firsthand if you can be the company that's doing that, and it's very hard to reproduce. And that's sort of what I've heard being described with Lemonade in a lot of cases. And so for that reason, that makes me feel strong conviction. I understand it's very highly valued, and there's going to be lots of shorts that, you know, they make their money by selling, you know, fear and unrest, you know, articles on whatever high price stock of the day there is. And so I haven't thoroughly read the Citron report or analysis, but have you read it? I mean, what do you
Well,
think
yeah, it
about
was
that?
kind of like a 7-minute video he released, and like his main two points was, number one, Lemonade is just an insurance company. They're not a tech company, right? They're like any other insurance company, State Farm, Farmers, right? They have no advantage at all. That's the first point. And the second point is, Lemonade is like basically lying to people because they say they're socially good co or for the benefit of, social good, but yet they don't donate enough, right, of their funds. And so that's like his main points. And then, I mean, and then of course the stock price is high argument. And the thing is, like, the stock price is high argument, I'm always like in a way empathetic toward that, because that's the argument which it could be, like even right now, if you look at Tesla and you're like, hey, stock price is too high, yeah, I'm not gonna argue, I'm like, yeah, I mean, maybe it's not, but sure, in the future, like I think with full self-driving coming out within 2 years, I think there could be, I mean, this realization that, oh my gosh, Tesla is in, multi-trillion dollar markets with all their products, et cetera. So I still see like But when you're talking about short term, like, you know, what's the stock worth is so subjective in some ways. You know, I'm not going to argue with people with that. But yeah, in that sense, like the same, the argument of like, oh, Lemonade is just an insurance company. Like, it's like Tesla is just a car company. Like, we still hear that, right, to this day. And yeah, it's amazing. I had this thought that it's amazing how so many smart people can really, I'm not going to say this on Citron because supposedly they had actually decent returns this past 2020. So they're doing decently well, supposedly overall. But I'm just saying in general, let's say with Tesla, but some other companies, usually it's not the smartest people who make the most money or who are the greatest, who do well in investing. You know, it's like oftentimes smart people, they get tripped up with,
They're like too smart for their own good or
yeah,
something.
it's like, I don't know. I'm still pondering this because I know someone who's very smart and a lot of degrees, a lot of expertise, experience. If anyone who meets him will be like, wow, this guy's really, really smart, right? Not average smart, but like, you know, top smart. But yet the person gets so tripped up with trying to make a quick decision. Like, you might hear something and say, oh my gosh, I need to sell everything right now, right? This is the worst thing. And I'm like, wait, did you even think through this, right? And like, it's kind of mind-baffling how, you know, sometimes I think maybe it's like they're used to making quick decisions, you know, with their work or something, and they're rewarded with that. They're like, okay, you know, smart person makes decisions. But I think sometimes with investing, when you just like get information and then quickly just say, make a conclusion, like this company is a fraud or this company is whatever, you know, I don't know if that's the right way to do it. I think maybe there's something about that where I don't know what it is. Is patience or maybe looking at it from more than one angle, trying to take your time and really like I think there's something that I've felt with investing where I think it could be the most difficult skill like out there, at least in our economy, because it's the highest, it returns the highest value in a sense,
It
right?
does, yeah. If you're good at it, it can
Yeah,
return
investing
crazy
and
astronomical
entrepreneurship,
things.
right? Those two things, so in some ways,
Entrepreneurship,
yeah, there's this crazy amount of difficultness to those skills, and I think,
A lot of risk in both of them,
yeah, exactly. Not a risk, but I think it takes maybe a myriad of different skills, not just an intellect of like a specialty angle, you know. I think that's where some shorts get tripped up, where they're like financially, I know P over E's and I know auto companies, and this is not, you know, this
I
is
know
like
spreadsheets, and
exactly.
this spreadsheet does not compare to the others. And I think so. Yeah, I think you have to think differently and be good at thinking differently and adjusting and being open-minded on ideas. And I mean, I think some people were asking like, oh, what was the other stock Emmett said he invested in, for example, and on the last podcast. And I'm you know, it was my head. I'm not going to disclose it, but I'm going to tell you. You know, I told basically I told you like a couple of days later, like, yeah, that stock I sold it. You know, like I realized I made a mistake, and I got took new information. I didn't have enough conviction. I took new information in that I hadn't thought of yet, and that just made me uncomfortable. And I had a little bit of a gain, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to close that position. And I adjusted. You know, like some people dig their heels in to their thoughts, and they can't adjust or think openly, like maybe I'm wrong, and change their actions. It's so hard for some people to change their mind, you know. And once you have an opinion on like Lemonade being overpriced, even if you haven't researched it super thoroughly, like it's going to be very hard to change that opinion of someone, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Especially the smarter the people are.
Last question here, and we'll wrap up. It's always fun chatting here. Jack from Twitter says, advice for younger audience who don't have the money for investments. And he lists kind of different things, which I mean, we can talk about whatever, but he says, what can we do now to raise ourselves higher in this decade? Any important life lessons, tips to become better at analysis, how to improve our vision ability, vision versus execution. So there's a bunch of different kind of themes, but yeah, I think generally, I mean, I'm hesitant actually to give so-called like advice in the sense that I don't know if like myself, if I really know what I'm talking about.
Well, at least you could say that, right? Most people don't want to say that.
And I would say the same, like I love, I want to say bursting, I want to say bursting your bubble, but I like bringing things to reality. Like I don't even think you know is like in terms of everything, you know what I'm saying? Like advice in a sense that this is sage advice that you know you should follow. I don't know what I'm really talking about
Everyone's
in some of this.
different. Everyone's got different experiences.
We'll share some ideas, right, that might not be even applicable that we're thinking through and working out. But anyways, that said, what are some thoughts? Like younger audience don't have, you know, let's say they don't have any money, and not just with investing, but you know, what to kind of do to
Get
overall.
ahead and stuff. So I think I'm just thinking of like a younger version, like you said, like I'm just imagining my own self being younger and what other people are like that I know that are younger. And I think it's important to find your passion and identify your passions. And you want to focus on earning a living, enough so that you can save money, right? Like you also want to have a cost of living that a difference between an earn how much money you make and how much you spend, right? So you need to have that difference to go into like your savings, to go into investments, and then your investing can be like a hobby that turns into something big and wonderful down the road. But if you don't give yourself that chance to do that, then it's going to be tough to really have any build up any capital to invest with. But that early decisions you make on, if you're young, test out a lot of different things to kind of identify your passions. And you don't want to be stuck in some kind of role or job or start some business that you don't even like just because you think it could make a lot of money. I think you want to do something that you like, but also has the opportunity to make money, right? So for me, early on in my life, after college, I was a personal trainer for like a year right out of college, and I liked that. But I saw like there's a ceiling, I could open my own gym maybe one day and work my butt off from like 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. and make a decent living as a small business owner at the gym. But I also knew that like I was very interested in the stock market and finance and stuff. And when I had an opportunity to kind of cross the chasm to a financial role, even though it was like back office, hourly worker in that business, I was like, all right, I'm going to take that chance to skip over to this industry because if I do really well, and I'm passionate about it, and I can work my way up, even though it was hard in the beginning, the ceiling could be much higher. And it taught me a lot about the markets and it helped me learn. There wasn't these types of YouTube channels back then, but now you have incredible resources online everywhere, so you can kind of learn about investing as a side hobby. It doesn't have to be your job to work in finance either. So that's my advice. Just make sure you can identify, balance something that you really enjoy with something that's, a way to make a living where you can earn enough to save something on the side. I don't know. What do you think? What's
No,
your.
that's great advice. I mean, actually, I want to link to that. Reminds me, I want to link to that podcast interview you did on, I forget the channel, but you talked,
Oh, Tech Nori with
Technori.
Scott
Yeah,
Tuned.
you talked more about kind of your early days of personal training and sorting mail and a bunch of other stuff. And I thought that was great. It was a fantastic interview. So yeah, I definitely
Oh,
want to link
thanks.
that. If people are interested in hearing more about Emmett's early days, that's definitely a great listen. So I mean, there's a lot of different angles I think, you know, one can take, and I think we can go on for hours and days on different things. But I think just for the sake of maybe giving one thing that someone can latch onto as an idea, one of the most important habits that I do, I don't think I've even shared this on this channel or too many people, is at nighttime, I will, not all the time, but sometimes I will take a problem that I'm wrestling with, and it has to be a big problem. So if it's just a tiny problem, it's like it's not really worth it. It needs to be a big problem that I feel like I don't have an answer for. It's like overwhelming, kind of like it's like my current brain just can't find the answer. You know, this is that type of problem, or I'm like, I don't see it. And what I'll do is I'll go to sleep with that problem in my mind, in the forefront of my thinking. Now, I'm not necessarily trying to find the solution like with all my effort at that moment when I'm sleeping. What I'm doing is I have this technique where I kind of focus my energy on this problem. And I focus my energy on saying I need to find some solution, but I can't. My mind is just can't grasp it right now. So I do that. I focus that, and I keep that thought that I need to find the answer to this problem. I need to find the answer to this problem until I fall asleep. And when I do that, what I do is I enter sleep, where I think it activates this like unconscious part of me, where I start to look at the angle from I don't know what. I don't know what's going on. I have like no clue what's going on. But it just I know something probably is going on. 'Cause what happens is sometimes the next morning I'll have some interesting ideas, but sometimes I don't, and I will do that again the next night. And I'll keep on doing this. And like some crazy things will happen. Like I actually will see like I'll see some ideas, like these pieces will come together in a way that I just didn't think was possible. Like one story of how one story was like, my parents were in a situation like back in 2012 or around that period. Like I looked at their retirement and like it wasn't, I wasn't happy with where they were financially. I had, so before I had kind of this thing of I need to help them get to a better place, you know? And I did the technique and I came up with this idea where I'm like, you know, they need to get four rental properties, and cash flow those rental properties and they'll be set. And I kind of set everything up for them. I picked the area. This was back in 2010, actually, where it was the bottom. And I found the perfect houses, the perfect area, the perfect realtor, the perfect lender, everything. And the whole plan was just like all in place for them just to follow it. And they met the realtor. They saw the houses. And initially they said, okay, this looks great. We'll do it. And then last minute they backed out and they're like, I don't want to like, I don't want to be a landlord. I don't want to be in the rental business. And so they passed on that opportunity. And then in 2013, like real estate started to go up and it was like over that whole opportunity for them. And I was like, man, they could have just had like their whole retirement completely changed, you know, if they just would have, you know, just took my advice. And so in 2013, I entered another thing of a couple of weeks of this, like at late at night, falling asleep with this problem. Say my parents' retirement, man, they missed the opportunity. What can they do, right? And then during this time, like I felt like Tesla was a fantastic opportunity, but I knew they couldn't handle the risk because it was they're in retirement. It just, you know, I couldn't figure out a way to make it happen. And this was at the time where like Elon Musk gave a guarantee. I don't know if you remember, I'm sure you remember this. Like there's something about the Model S, was it the battery or something, that there's all this media like FUD against it, and Elon had to come and it was a resale guarantee.
Yeah, of a certain price
That
after
that
3
Tesla had
years or
to,
something.
yeah, the guaranteed the resale price. And then Elon said, even if Tesla goes bankrupt, I will personally guarantee it.
Yeah,
And
I remember that.
yeah, this was like, this was crazy because I mean, probably most people forget this, or you know, they don't know this story. But yeah, he said, "I will personally guarantee, even if Tesla goes bankrupt." And I start to think about that. I'm like, "Wow, what does that mean?" You know, like Tesla goes bankrupt, all of his Tesla stock goes to zero. That means he's gonna take his SpaceX stock and put it all, or you know, liquidate or something, whatever, to follow through. So he's literally betting the rest of his assets into this thing, right? And it was like a risky move on Elon's part, but it was like genius in a way. You know, it's like who, what other CEO would do something like that? You know, like at that moment, it was just, it was quintessential Elon Musk, you know? And so he had that, you know, I was like, wow, that's amazing. So anyways, all this stuff is happening. I'm going to bed late at night, thinking about my parents' retirement, like, I'm like, what
She
can
said,
I
I'm going to
do?
personally guarantee them if the Tesla goes down.
Exactly. So what happened was one morning I woke up. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got it. I understand it. I'm going to do a guarantee just like Elon Musk. I'm going to personally guarantee every single share that they buy, that anything that they buy, if whatever it goes lower than the purchase price, I will guarantee it, like after 5 years. So after, if they hold it for 5 years, if it goes to zero, I will pay them back. Like I will pay the whole amount that they
Wow.
purchase, right?
Yeah. It's a lot of pressure on you.
Yeah. But I mean, it just came to me. I'm
But
like,
you felt
this,
comfortable.
I'm like, this is it. This is the idea. This is how they can get into Tesla, because otherwise, how can they get into a risky stock like Tesla at their retirement age? I'm like, it doesn't, there's no financial like wisdom to get an old, elderly person in a risky stock. It just doesn't, that's crazy, right? But if I guarantee it, then it makes sense. They have zero to lose, right? So I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the idea. So I package this whole thing. I write like a series of 10 emails. I describe the company, I describe the opportunity, I describe my projections 5 years out, I describe why they need to hold for 5 years, and I describe my guarantee. And I say, if you put up in this amount of money to buy this amount of shares, I will guarantee 100%, so you won't lose a single dollar after 5 years, right? And I told them, I have the assets to back it up. And we actually had to, like it was actually a lot of pressure in that sense, because like I couldn't go fully into Tesla in the sense I had to keep some real estate and some stuff to like as a complete hedge, And well, I guess we had our business at that time, that was also an asset too. But it was amazing what happened, because it was the perfect solution for them. It allowed them to buy what they needed to buy, and then it put a lot of pressure on us in some ways, but it was manageable pressure, because it wasn't a crazy sum of money that we couldn't pay back. We knew we could
Yeah, you
deal
had your
with
other
it.
business
Yeah,
going and
exactly. We could
everything.
do it. And that one idea completely transformed my parents' like retirement, like unbelievably, like black and white, just like it just, and their lives are changed, And they thank me profusely every time they meet me because of that decision, of that idea. And that whole idea came out of like, just a few
Stewing
weeks.
on it at night.
Yeah, the few weeks of sleeping on it, kind of, and trusting that something will happen in my unconscious type of processing to come up with something that I didn't think of before. And I mean, this is kind of, drawn out story, but I feel like people don't tap into that much. Like, and I feel like it's a superpower that people have, that if they would learn to tap into it, they could do amazing things, like far greater
I
than most
agree.
people can realize.
I actually do that a lot too, and I can
Really?
tell, that's I feel like I naturally go to sleep like thinking of my issues, but I'm able to fall asleep, and then sometimes I get great solutions, and it's happened to me a number of times. And I used to not do that because I used to have like a for many years as I was growing up, I had a TV in my room, and I would in my bedroom, and I'd watch TV, and it would like put me to sleep, So you rob yourself of the opportunity when you go to sleep that way, I think, and a lot of people do. But yeah, I think if you can go to sleep, in your own thoughts, thinking about stuff like that, sometimes it can stress people out and keep them up at night, right? But if you can think of it in a way where it doesn't stress you out like that, and you can still fall asleep just thinking productively about it, but not letting it get to you in an anxious way, it can be very helpful.
So what I figured out is how not to let it stress you out. And the way I do it is you get stressed out if you think your brain can actually try to solve, has the capacity to solve that problem, like by effort and by trying hard. So you think that, but if you kind of take a step back and say, there are certain problems and certain angles I can't see, I can't even try to see, then, and I'm not going to solve it right now. Like the whole idea is when you go to sleep thinking about it, you're not trying to solve it, because what you're trying to do is you're saying, I'm going to rely on my subconscious that's going to do its own work overnight, and I'm
To
not going
think
to,
differently about it.
exactly, like I can't solve it right now. And so in a way, you're admitting defeat in a sense of your, it's kind of separating your brain in your process, like saying, my conscious brain can't do it, and it stresses me out. And I need the other part of myself, brain, the subconscious, to come in. And I don't hear many
And it's
people
funny how
talking about this
sometimes in the
though.
morning you think of these like amazing ideas that you're like, wow, those ideas, they come to you in the shower in the morning, whatever. I don't know, you just have a different mind every morning than it's been able to practice. But it's interesting that you kind of actively practice this. I guess I just do it sometimes and I don't even think about it, but I should maybe more actively try to practice it.
It's completely life changing. I mean, and it's funny. It's like I don't even I've never necessarily heard about this. I mean, maybe some people talk about it, but it's just something over the years, I've caught on to, and it gives me an immense amount of confidence to come up with ideas to issues or situations. But all right, man. Anyways,
All right.
we'll wrap up here, but thanks. I know you're on vacation kind of, right?
Yeah, I'm in Palm Springs at the moment. Just taking the long weekend in a warmer weather, driving up Monday morning back to the Bay Area. So, yeah, I took my Tesla down, stopped at a few superchargers, stopped at the Kettleman City supercharger for the first time. That was cool. But yeah, it was a fun trip. Yeah. So thanks for I brought my microphone, so just in case we were gonna do a chat or something. So I'm glad we did it.
It's always fun. I love chatting, and always learn a lot of stuff. And so anyways, best wishes on 2021, and we'll talk again in our next episode. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
All right, see ya.